The Orange FM.
Ready to form Voltron. Activate interlocks. Dinotherms connected. Impracel up. Mega thrusters are go.
Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, and this is Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast, and I'm here with Mike French. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, how you doing, Mark?
I'm doing great. This is like the grandfather of Voltron is here with us today.
And yet he's kept his looks.
Yes. All right, we're going all the way back 30 years to the 30th anniversary of Voltron this year, and one of the best interviews you're going to see this year is Franklin Kofod, the original director, producer, showrunner, everything for this show.
Princess, our prayers are answered.
All right, I want to introduce Mr. Franklin Kofod to the podcast. Welcome, Franklin.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to hear from you too, Mike.
I'm honored to be talking to you, sir. I've seen your name in lights at the end of many a cartoon, and I feel like you've been with me a long time. Just we didn't know each other, so.
Well, it was a fun time, I must say.
So, Franklin, what have you been up to lately?
Lately, for the last 2.5 or 3 years, I was working on a project for the Armenian Film Foundation. And I was reassembling in 16mm interviews that were done with witnesses and survivors of the Armenian genocide that were done starting like in the 70s, about 400 interviews. So that's pretty much wrapped up right now. We turned it over to the Shoah Foundation at USC, which is sort of the go-to place for interviews with the Holocaust interviews are there that Steven Spielberg did. I'm retired again.
Okay. All right. So we're going to step back 30 years and we're going to go back to the beginning. And how is it that you got involved with the Voltron project?
One day I got a call from Peter Keefe. I had been editorial supervisor on Battle of the Planets, which was probably before Voltron, the most successful remake of any Japanese cartoon series. Some 4 or 5 people had the idea of how to do this. And obviously it was a post-production job, and they hired me to sort of figure the rest of it out and get it done. So I think we did 85 episodes of that, and by the time we had 85 episodes done, I had it pretty well honed. So anyhow, Peter called, and he said that they wanted to remake a Japanese cartoon series. And, you know, he talked about, you know, translating it and doing like a speed racer job. And I said, well, that hasn't really proved very successful. And what you really want to do is what we did with Battle of the Planets. And he asked what we did with Battle of the Planets. And I said, you know, essentially we went back and took the picture. And I don't want to say wrote new stories, but, you know, weren't tied to the translation. We did new music and, you know, and dialogue. So anyway, I explained what the process was and how we went about it. And he was pretty much convinced after the first conversation or two that that's the approach they should take, which would obviously entail a lot more money. Within 2 months, we had made a pilot, which we took to NAB in San Francisco. And I think that was in like February of 1984. We had like a world premiere. It was fairly successful. It went on from there.
Now, I have a question. The first time that Peter Keefe talked to you about this, did he describe what was going on in Beast King Go Lion, or did he describe to you what was going on in Die Ruger, or how they wanted to combine the two?
He said that the concept was they wanted to make do 125 episodes. Copper Communications is a broadcasting enterprise. Ted Koppler, the head of Koppler Communications, was interested in the aspect of selling it as, you know, as a broadcast entity. So the actual creative in what it was wasn't, you know, wasn't his great thrust. But Peter said that they had found two or three, you know, Japanese robot series. And the concept was that it would be a trilogy, and with 52 episodes totaling, 156 shows, we could probably get, 40, 45 from each one and do a total of 125 episodes, because everybody knew that there would be episodes that, you know, would be totally unusable. So the concept was the Voltron trilogy.
Now, they knew that they were going to be unusable because of the violence that was a part of it?
Yeah, basically violence, yeah.
Okay. So had you seen any of that before you made your pilot?
Seen any of the episodes?
All the violence and stuff that you knew you were going to have to...
Well, we saw a couple of episodes. I don't remember how many we saw, but we certainly didn't see all of them by any means. But the first pilot we made was a vehicle show.
And whose call was it to make it Vehicle Voltron?
I think in the time frame we had, that was probably all we had. We had, either an interpositive or a good 16mm print from which we could go ahead. So I think it was based on what was at hand, because we had a very, very short period of time to do it.
Right. You only had like 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah, yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so with you and Peter together, who else was working with you on the pilot?
Well, Jameson Brewer, who I worked with on Battle of the Planets. Paul Vitello did the sound effects. The music we got from a library, and Dale Shacker edited the music. Anyhow, it was it was a handful of people who put it together.
And who brought Paul Vitello and Dale Shacker into the mix?
I brought Dale and I brought everybody in.
Oh, okay.
I mean, everybody who, well, I won't say totally, but 90% of the people ever worked on the show I brought in.
Okay, and so how did you know Dale Shacker?
I met Dale. He was out here with a friend of his who was doing a documentary about trying to find the Titanic. And Dale lived in Tampa, St. Petersburg, somewhere down there in Florida. And this guy, whose name escapes me, Mike something. Anyhow, he made this documentary, and they wanted to enter it for an Academy Award. And Dale wrote the music for it. And I don't remember exactly how we all got, together, but anyhow, some final editing stuff needed to be fixed or something, and somehow somebody referred the guy who produced the documentary to me, and Dale had composed and conducted the music with a symphony orchestra down there. It was just incredible music, I thought. So at that point, we started a friendship, and I had him. That was probably a couple of years before we did Voltron. You know, he was number one in my music Rolodex.
All right. And how about Jameson Brewer? Where did he come from?
Well, I worked with Jameson on Battle of the Planets. So I think that Jameson came along slightly after Jesus.
Okay.
Because he was, he'd been around forever. And he was an old guy when I, when I met him, which was, way back when. So Jameson was interesting. We would go, he lives in Thousand Oaks and I live in Thousand Oaks. So that was part of a nice connection. And we would go into Hollywood. I guess that's about 40 miles, I guess, from here to Hollywood, or 25 miles or something. And so he and I would go to Hollywood frequently together, and we'd have lunch at his favorite spot, Tail of the Cock. And he actually had his name on a bar stool. That's what a regular was for decades.
Wow.
So all his friends would come by and, pay homage and say hello and all this. And they'd say, what are you working on? And he'd say, I have 8 or 10 projects that are in various stages of disintegration. So he was a really bright guy. And very creative.
When you brought him on and you told him that you were going to do this adaptation of Japanese anime, and you were going to combine Die Ruger and Beast King Goline. Did he think this was all going to work?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, he was a miracle worker. You know, he could do you know, it's amazing what he would put together and come up with.
Okay. And then the other person was Paul Vitello.
The thing about Paul was, yeah, I sort of got together and we talked about this project, and I knew other sound effects people and one thing and another, but you know, he got the concept, and he really wanted to do it, and he was into it 100%. And in the end, for the show, I mean, they built a studio. They had there were more employees on the sound effects side than there were in the rest of the entire operation. I mean, it was amazing, you know, how much it took, you know, to do the sound effects for the show.
Mm-hmm. So also with the sound effects for the show, we also had to do stereophonics, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We decided early on, Ted decided early on that it would be, you know, that we should, the show should be stereo because stereo was going to come out in the fall. You know, when Voltron came on. So it's very interesting because it really was the first stereo show. And, you know, back, you know, 30 years ago, we didn't have the box stores that we have now. You had a local television, you know, store that sold TVs. The stores loved the Voltron show because they could show off their stereo TVs, and kids would actually go to the television stores and watch Voltron.
Right.
Not necessarily buy a TV, but they would go there in the afternoon, I guess, on their way home from school and watch Voltron in stereo.
Well, that's what I did. I watched it after school.
Yeah.
All right. So can you paint me a picture of how you were putting together the pilot for the National Association of Broadcasters Conference?
I'm pretty sure that I did the first pilot I did in film. So what I probably did is I took a 16mm print and I made a reversal print or a black and white print from that, and I edited from that. Jameson wrote a pilot, and that meant that, you know, he came up with all the names, he, you know, all the dialogue, and he did that in a matter of, you know, less than a week. We cast all the voices. And, you know, there were the voices, you know, that went on and did the entire series.
So, did you have to use a casting agent or something like that to get those?
Actually, I did use a casting agent because it was a big deal and I knew it was going to be 125 episodes. And, you know, I thought the best way for me to go about it, because obviously I had a few other things on my plate, was to go to, and I forget the guy's name, but the company was called The Voice Caster. And we sat down and I told him basically what we wanted to do. And, you know, we talked about, you know, who would be good and who do we want to interview. And I don't know, I guess the cast was about six people. So, you know, we've probably interviewed, I don't know, 25 people, I guess, something like that.
Okay. Was there a specific character that you needed to have first?
I think what we did is we, you know, just brought people in and, you know, gave them an idea of what the show was about. And of course it was an individual. I mean, there was only, you know, Peter, me, Jameson might've been there. You know, a guy from the voice caster, an engineer, you know, and an actor would come in and we'd, you know, sort of talk about what it was we wanted to do and everything. And then they'd go in the booth and, you know, we'd work on something. And, you know, they came up with what they thought would be good, and we refined that. But the most important thing was we used, you know, I don't want to say the six best people in town, but six of the dozen best people in town. And that was because they had the ability to do three different voices, and you wouldn't, you know, a normal viewer wouldn't say Hunk and Pidge are the same guy. Actually, Hunk and Pidge weren't the same guy.
Yeah, Neil Ross did Pidge and Keith.
Yeah, Pidge and Keith, right. And Neil, of all the people, Neil, to get back to the three voice thing, the SAG contract for cartoons says that, you know, when you hire a voice actor, they can do up to three voices for the session fee. So, you know, that would allow us to hire six people and essentially, you know, have 18 voices in the show. you know, pretty doable for the Lions, but it was really difficult for the vehicle shows. You know, it was a pretty incredible cast.
Now, was it true that at the beginning, Neil only knew that he was doing Keith, and then, like, a little bit later on, they asked him about this other character, and he didn't necessarily know it was one of the main characters?
Well, when we first cast it and we did the pilot, we were doing vehicle shows. You know, it was a vehicle show. So the Lion thing never really entered into it, you know, but we just adapted the cast to the, you know, to the Lion thing when we, the Lion series, when we, you know, when we got to it, which I think the second pilot we made was probably a Lion show.
Did somebody say that you wanted to have Pidge be a character that sounded like he had his nose pinched all the time or something like that?
Yeah, I'm sure that Jameson and Peter and I, you know, worked on, you know, what would be good. And, you know, he just looked like his nose was pinched all the time.
Did you have to go by the way that the Japanese actors had made the characters and determine how you were going to make them from an American version? Or did that not play into it at all?
There's very little of the Japanese series that we availed ourselves of. Basically, we just took the, you know, we took the picture, you know, and we, you know, would look at it and say, you know, that's got to go, what's going on here, you know, and, you know, spend 20 minutes, you know, zipping through it, fast forward with Jameson, and said, okay, and Jameson said, okay, well, we'll do yada, 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 and, you know, a week later, we'd have a script, a rough draft, and we'd work from that.
Okay.
There were a couple of shows that we didn't understand, and we had translations, or we had it translated here. We didn't get translations with the series. We had the shows translated here, and, you know, we looked at it, and, you know, looked at the show, looked at the translations, looked at each other and said, we still don't understand it, you know.
was that a Japanese culture type of thing that you didn't understand, or?
Part of it probably was.
Okay.
You know, but anyhow, I was very impressed with your interview with Mark Handler, who is in my book, a genius. He took over, he wrote a lot of the first 100 shows. And then he did the original shows that got us to 124 or whatever it was, 20, however, original episodes we did.
Right.
I had a question that was related to this.
Okay.
When you would run into these moments of, you know, extreme violence or just subject matter, because I've watched both Go Lion and Voltron separately, but I've watched them multiple times to really understand the differences. And some of the editing in Voltron is quite clever to get around that while keeping the running time similar.
Yeah.
How did you guys, do you remember moments where, I mean, what was that like when you would run into those sections and you'd go, okay, how am I going to fill this and make it seem seamless?
That was the track I was on. My train was on that track to talk about what Mark was talking about the reels we made. Remember when Mark Handler was talking about we made like stock reels?
Right.
Yeah. So anyhow, we made stock reels of sequences from episodes, and then we would then plug those into episodes where we had to take, you know, remove half of it or whatever. I don't know if we ever removed that much or not, but anyhow, removed a lot of it. And it was very interesting because many times I think the format, I think the show, the basic two acts of the show had to be about 19 or 21 minutes or something like that. And sometimes they'd end up 12 minutes and sometimes they'd end up 32 minutes.
Wow.
And it really didn't, you know, it didn't really have a feel for where it was going just looking at the script, you know, and we didn't spend a lot of time, you know, timing it out. We just recorded it. So, you know, the ones that were short, we had to figure out how to make them a little longer. And the ones that were long, as we were talking earlier, you know, you just a lot of it has to go. And some of it, you know, would go and we would then use it in another show later on or whatever. It was an interesting time.
So
the other thing I want to talk about, that Mark was talking about, it was talking about how we recorded. the shows. And Mark was saying we recorded it to a stopwatch. And part of that was, you know, normal for a cartoon, you would get the entire cast together and you'd sit around a table and you'd do like a rehearsal, you know, in the morning, you know, run through it a couple of times and then have lunch and come back and record it in the afternoon. But the talent that we had just, you know, could not give us that kind of time. So we were sort of forced to do it by stopwatch. And each actor came in and read his lines, her lines individually. And I did. I sat there with a little electronic stopwatch and, you know, I would time every speech and say, I need to be a little shorter and a little longer, split the difference. And, you know, we'd record each line, you know, two or three times at least, you know, just in case, you know, there was some pop or scratch we didn't hear or whatever. Then that was recorded on half-inch time-coded tape, four-track tape. We would record the dialogue, and that was then transferred to three-quarter-inch cassette, and then we went into an offline suite and, you know, edited each individual line from there. You know, we did the series in tape.
Can you describe what offline suite means?
Yeah, an offline editing suite is if you you know, think about, you know, Final Cut Pro or something like that, and just think of, you know, every source you have, you need to have a machine playing that tape back.
Right.
Okay. And other than that difference, it's very similar to what Final Cut Pro is, other than you have an enormous amount of shuttle time all the time, you know, rolling the tapes, you know, back and forth. And of course, when they're, you know, if you have, you know, three or four different actors working in one scene, then you have, you know, three or four tapes going because, you know, they weren't recorded ensemble.
All right. So how many tracks would you be working with at the same time in an offline suite?
Well, you only have two.
Okay.
The two tracks that are on the, you know, the three-quarter inch tape had two audio tracks.
Okay.
It was three-quarter inch tape was a, you know, a very primitive process. You know, I remember one of the few people I ever hired that came out of a film school, and he came out of UCLA film school. And I asked him one day, I said, Chris, what's the greatest lesson you learned in film school? And he said, not to judge color on a Trinitron monitor. Remember old Sony Trinitron monitors?
I remember those.
Yeah.
When I was in film school, the lesson I learned the hard way, because I cut my thesis on 16 millimeter,
yeah,
was when you cut or edit, make sure that you carefully decide where you're going to edit so you only cut once.
Because
mm-hmm. putting
true.
Frames back in is hard.
Yeah. And what's even harder is finding those frames.
Yes.
You know?
Trim bin.
The trim bin, yeah. What got me into the film business was my father and his brother had a film company in New York, and I like to say that it was you know, a genetic imperfection that that got me into the film business. And they had a post production company, and you know, eventually I ended up in post production. What's really funny is my cousin was a pilot in Vietnam, and he had an ear problem. And so he got grounded and he ended up running a film laboratory in Vietnam.
That's nuts.
So, you know, it's sort of like a genetic imperfection, I guess.
Well, speaking of those, the pressure that you've, you know, found yourself under, because I can relate, because I've always been in the film business as well, you know, deadlines and whatever. Do you happen to remember when you were working on the vehicle episodes, the moment they came to you and said, we're switching gears, we're going into this lion show? I mean, was that something that you guys were ready for? What did it take to change the rails or change the tracks on that?
Peter and I worked out a schedule, and we had a drop dead date to start. And, you know, everybody had sort of signed on to that. But, you know, when we got close to that date, World Events wasn't ready to pull the trigger and get started. So from that point on, we were always behind the eight ball, and we're always behind it. It's sounds funny to say, but, you know, Dale, as for instance, for music, you know, he had one day, you know, to do the music. And what he would do is he would edit it sort of, overall at home and take notes. And then he would go into a studio, which was, controlled like a three quarter inch editing suite, but it was an audio suite. And, by time code, he would then, assemble, the music from the library. And, sometimes, there could be, 100 edits in a show. I mean, the way he put the music together is, I have never known anybody that could come close to the magic that he did with the music. It was amazing.
Dale Shacker was doing the music for the episodes, but they had brought on John Peterson to do the original theme music, right?
Yeah. John Peterson did the original theme music. And I obviously pitched Dale to do the music for the show, but the decision was made to go with somebody who had, a name. And so John Peterson, did the theme song, the very stirring theme song, an amazing piece of music. Dale and John worked on Library together because John had never composed a library for, a film series or a cartoon series. And then later on, Dale wrote, and we recorded, additional music, some more music. But Dale understood how the music had to go together. So when he and John were working on it, there would be a theme that would be, Keith's theme or whatever, Princess's theme, and that would go on. Then there would be like four or five bridges that he would use, and then there would be some endings. And he would just, take those pieces. I mean, it was recorded, it was composed and recorded to be cut up, but it sounds like one piece of music. And I've said, many times, especially with Voltron, the music is what drives it for, from the main title to the end title. And, it's there constantly and it's, it creates the emotion.
And would you say that in Voltron, the music drives the show even more so than any other show you had worked on?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely. And to the point that, Dale would constantly say to me, there's too much music. There shouldn't be music here. I say, hey, the engine's got to keep going.
As far as the importance of the music to the show and selling it to the broadcasters and what made the show popular and get good ratings and everything, would you say the music was at least, 25% of the entire package?
I think it's certainly a big factor. I think the voices, were an enormous factor, and it was a complete package. With the voices and, the music and the sound effects. And, when you come right down to it, it was probably, the most successful, remake of a Japanese series probably ever. What we had to work with was just, the picture. I remember Ted talking to the guy who owned the studio that eventually we did Denver with. And Denver was original animation that we did Calico. And Calico is owned by Tom Burton and Tom and Claudia Burton. And part of what their business was doing station IDs. And they had done station IDs for Copler Communications for the station in Sacramento and St. Louis. So Ted runs into Tom one day and says, hey, we're doing a cartoon series. And Tom looks at him and says, really? And he said, yeah. And he said, Tom said, tell me about it. And said, oh, well, we're doing the stories and we're doing music and we're doing sound effects and all. And Tom said, well, where's the animation? He said, oh, that comes from Japan. So it was
almost like it's second nature.
Minimize it. That's what they do. It's animation. We were stuck with the images that we had. We, later on we did some original ones, but, for the first 100 and however many it was, those were the pictures we had and we had to make something of it. So my feeling was, you need to, get the best music we can get. Do the sound effects the best way we can do them. We had an advantage because we were going to do it in stereo and get the best voices. And we had great writers.
All right. So how many of the episodes would you say were ready before you debuted in September 10th of 1984?
Not very many. I don't remember. You know, I've heard this spoken about since then. And, you know, I've heard numbers like 6 or 10. But I'm thinking that the show was distributed by satellite. And I believe that the show was uplinked the week before it ran. So in other words, early on Monday morning, they would uplink the following Monday's show. So if that was the case, five of them were already in the broadcaster's hands. I don't know, but I do know that you know, after 3 weeks or so, we were rerunning shows because we didn't have enough, didn't produce enough. And that's why I was saying earlier that you have one day to do everything you can for this show, because tomorrow you're on to another show.
Right. So in the beginning, you were showing the Lion Force or the Vehicle Force when you first started?
I think we were doing both.
Okay.
I seem to remember in my market in Tennessee that that Lions was on weekdays for a while, and then Voltron, or the Vehicle Voltron, was on like Saturday or Sunday for a while, and then once Lion ended, Vehicle Voltron kind of took over the afternoon weekday slot. But that's my memory, and my memory from back then is shoddy. So
yeah,
right. But when did you first know that the ratings for the Lion Force episodes were stronger?
The first thing that we realized when we got into it was that the animation in the Lion shows was enormously better than the animation in the Vehicle shows, and that sort of detracts from my feeling is because I'm a Vehicle show guy. I like the Vehicle shows. My favorite character is Hawkins, Commander Hawkins. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was just, you know, I mean, he's like the man. And, you know, he held, you know, kept those 15 kids, you know, in line, and it was good. But we realized early on that, you know, the Lion stuff was better. They were certainly easier to write and produce because there weren't as many characters. But of course, in the Vehicle show, I mean, all 15 characters never appeared, you know, never had lines or, you know, speeches in every show.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, it would shift around what they were, but it was a interesting time for sure.
It was a lot of work.
All right, so you're into the first year's worth of episodes, and how is it going for the whole production crew? Is it working like clockwork, you know, is it crazy, or are you guys handling it?
It's crazy, but, you know, back then I was a bit of a bulldozer and I didn't let anything get in my way. And, you know, I handpicked the people, and there were people I knew I could rely on. I was very fortunate. Associate producer and was Mary Roscoe, and she worked for Chuck Jones for, I don't know, 12 or 15 years, you know, before she came to work for me. And we worked on some other project individually before that, in a few years before Voltron. And, you know, she was the one that sat in the, you know, in the offline suite in the editing and supervised the editing and, you know, made sure it went together right and it worked. And, you know, she made a lot of decisions about what, you know, what stayed and what went.
Franklin, can you tell us a little bit about the overall climate at that time in the animation industry, because these shows were just exploding. Everybody was trying to get into the weekday afternoon market, whether through syndication or through a network. And I know you were working amongst professionals that were working on all sorts of different shows. You know, Peter Cullen was on Transformers at the same time. Can you kind of give us a little idea of what that landscape was like and who you, you know, got to associate with, and maybe some of the things they told you at the time? What, you know, were you guys talking shop, and what, you know, what was that environment like back then?
We didn't talk a lot of shop about other shows. There was never much of that. You know, when the actors came in, you know, it was the most entertaining part of the whole thing, because you know, they're always funny. You know, they get down to business. they spend, you know, if they don't have very many lines, they're in there for 20 minutes and they're joking around for 15 of that and do their lines in five and they're gone. And it was just, without that, I probably would have gone crazy without, you know, being able to, get away, two, three afternoons a week and go record dialogue for the shows.
Right.
But it's true that, what's it, Hasbro, that's Transformers?
Right.
Yeah. They were coming from the toy manufacturer avenue. Okay. Koppler was coming at it from the broadcaster avenue or right. street. Okay. So Hasbro was what they were making was, it was a half hour commercial for toys.
Uh huh.
Okay. World Events was just trying to sell it as a program for broadcasters, and not that the merchandising was secondary, but the merchandising was not driving the property at the beginning.
Gotcha.
Obviously, once it became very successful, everybody wanted to merchandise something, you know, whether it was sheets or slippers or cigarette holders, I don't know, everything.
Now, was it initially in your thought that you guys were going to develop some merchandising, or did that just sort of hit you with the licensors?
My initial pitch was that, they need to, and it was a barter deal whereby the show came with advertising. So essentially, in most cases, and I'm not that familiar with how World Events ran that business end of it. Okay, because I was on a creative end and we produced the shows and sales and marketing was in St. Louis. When I pitched doing the show with new music and sound effects and not just doing a translation and using the M&E track from Japan, what my pitch was that you need to make enough money to cover the cost of the production from the barter advertising that goes with each show to each market. The merchandising is the gravy, is the profit. And, that was that many times over. It did work.
So who was the first company that came to you wanting to do Voltron merchandise?
I was not – the merchandising was, was Peter's then. Peter operated out here. He was here. He lived here. And that was about the only connection we had to St. Louis. Teichmann was out here for a little while, but we were pretty much autonomous. I like to say that we made the show. We never sent it back there for any approvals. The first time they saw it in St. Louis was when it was uplinked. It came down by satellite, and they would make a cassette, and that was the first time they would see it. Ted would be out here, once or twice a month, and we'd show him the shows, and as we were producing them, but that was just, it was just bits and pieces at that point.
We had talked when we had interviewed you about the book,
right?
And you had mentioned you would print out a schedule on a daisy wheel printer and an IBM Selector typewriter. Can you tell me that story?
I made a schedule in a program called WordStar, a word processing program called WordStar. And I had a daisy wheel printer that was, 17 inches wide, and that had pin-fed green bar paper, that was perforated and would sort of fold together.
Yeah, going way back for this.
Yeah. And I would, I'd make a schedule, on what day sound effects had to be done, what day music was going to be, laid back or laid down, what they were going to mix, what they were going to, record voices, what day the script was due, whatnot. And I would, print it out at, here at home and, on this green bar paper and then distribute it to everybody.
And how long would that take to print?
Oh, yeah, that would take to print. Obviously everything was crazy, and I lived 25 miles from, where our offices were. So Monday morning, I would go in real early and that would be like maybe 5 a.m. And, you know, I wouldn't get home till late at night. And then on Tuesday, I'd go in a little later. And by the time it got to be Friday, I'd be going in around noon, you know,
right,
just so I could get some sleep. And, you know, it's it was quite a grind. So anyhow, I would we didn't have email. Jameson Brewer actually typed every script out, retyped every script on a little old it was an IBM Selectric typewriter. And you know, it wasn't till later on that you know, they were retyped and you know, put on a computer.
All right. Can you tell me about Peter Keefe? He was the ringleader of the whole operation. Can you tell me about him?
Well, he was quite a dynamic guy. He always dressed smartly, cowboy boots, handlebar mustache, blonde hair, which I suspect was dyed or bleached or something. And he always spoke with authority. And he was a wild guy, but you know, without him, the show never would have happened. It never would have gotten off the ground. But you know, he was involved in every facet. He would show up for most recording sessions. We would mix the shows in the evening, like starting like at 7 o'clock for 4 or 5 hours. And, you know, he would show up, you know, late in the evening when we were getting close to finishing and, you know, look at it. And, you know, that was the last time you got to make any changes. And it still wasn't too late to make some, you know, some picture fixes if we needed them. He approved every bit of merchandising, every product that ever went through, anything that was there's an art department, Bill England in Koppler in St. Louis. And, you know, the volume of stuff that came out of there was just amazing. And, you know, Peter went through every bit of it and made sure that, you know, it was his standard. You know, I mean, no question about it, he was Voltron.
There was something you had said about when he would send out mail or something, that he would also include what?
When Peter would send out, you know, something about merchandising or anything to anybody, or, you know, a cassette of the show or whatever, he always included an 8x10 glossy. And it was a black and white picture headshot. And he had some gray hairs in his mustache, and he would take a ballpoint pen and he would go over the gray in his mustache. And
just to cover it up.
To cover it up, yeah. And if you looked at it slightly to the light, you could see where it was inked over, you know, the glisten that you know, that a ballpoint pen leaves. But I don't want to say he was overly vain, but he was a pretty vain guy, yeah.
Well, he was also in pretty good shape too, right?
He was in really good shape, yeah. He certainly was. And he I think he kickboxed, and he rode horses, fox hunted. Yeah, he was quite a guy. When I heard he died, I just couldn't believe it.
Yeah, we miss him.
I looked at many different series that were really the predecessors or the precursors of anime, and selected the ones that had the most appeal, the most lodestone appeal. The underlying property had a huge lodestone appeal for all kinds of kids and adults.
Let me go back to when you guys first knew that Voltron was a hit. What was the reaction of the production crew at the time, or did you not even get a chance to react? You were just so hard at work.
Well, we were pretty proud of what we had done, but we didn't have any time to gloat or anything, you know. We saw the ratings and we knew it was good. And, you know, you're in the middle of the war and you might be on, you know, the 30 or the 35th episode, and you know, you got like half again, or twice as many more to do, you know, just, you know, to start with. And even at that point, we were still working with the concept that it was going to be a trilogy, you know, that there were going to be three different robots, and it was going to be Voltron of the near universe, the middle universe, and the far universe. And it wasn't a time where we had, you know, where we could celebrate by any means. One day, my wife hears a knock on the door, and she opens the door, and there's this little kid there, and he says, "Is it true that the producer of Voltron lives here?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "Wow!" And he turned around and walked away.
What, he didn't even stay to talk?
No. Well, I wasn't here. I was working.
Oh. Now, you have children and grandchildren. Are they Voltron fans?
They are. My grandson certainly is. I got a note from my... I sent a note to my... I have two daughters in San Diego, and I sent a note to them and told them about, you know, I was going to do this podcast and one thing or another. I have a grandson, and his mom, Kim, sent a note back saying, Mark will just love this. You know, so, hi, Mark. How you doing?
Shout out to Mark.
Shout out to Mark, yeah. Yeah, he's 11. He's a good kid.
By the way, there's a lot of Voltron fans that are named Mark.
Yeah.
We have learned.
Yeah. Starting with Mark Handler.
Yep, that's right.
That's you're both M-A-R-C Marks.
That's right.
Yeah, my grandson's M-A-R-K.
And speaking of Marks, this marks the halfway point of our interview with Franklin Kofod. Join us next week as we conclude our interview and Franklin answers questions from Voltron fans around the world. Join us next week on Let's Voltron!